Okay, well, thanks for inviting me along. I was invited to give a talk which I'd previously given in London at the Jolsock in London, which was part of the William Smith celebrations, the bicentenary celebrations, and it was all about mapping and different forms of mapping, geological mapping. And I was invited along to actually give an impression of how we map more recent materials, more recent sediments, more specifically related to quaternary geology. And for us in this country, quaternary geology predominantly means glacial sediments, to some extent also periglacial sediments, but predominantly glacial sediments. And that's where my expertise lies. I'm a glacial geomorphologist. I am a geographer. I make no apologies for the fact that I am a geographer. But where I learned my craft, as you'll see in a minute, was actually mostly in North America, in Canada in particular, where quaternary geology is actually well embedded in both geology and physical geography. And so I was trained along with geologists in mapping quaternary geology. So today what I want to give you is a rundown of a lot of work we've been doing in the past with respect to not only mapping quaternary glacial deposits, but also the interpretation of quaternary glacial deposits based upon what we call modern analogues, whereby we can actually look at modern day processes, glacial processes, and use the distribution of those processes and also the forms to interpret what we see in the ancient glacial record. So I'm going to be showing you some examples of mapping of glacial sediments in recent settings, in modern settings, where glacial ice is only just retreating from the landscape and allowing us to look at what's being produced in that landscape in almost in real time. And this and the survey work we've been doing in relationship to that I'll also talk about in terms of mapping and charting process form changes through time. And I'll also give you some examples of some applications we've done with modern glacier settings with respect to some mining and engineering geology applications. So let's move us on if I can hit the right buttons. Yes, great. So as I said, my training in terms of the mapping of quaternary geology came in Canada. And I'm going to give you a Canadian perspective largely because, as I said, that's largely where I learned my craft, but also because we've applied some of the aspects of Canadian quaternary geology to the mapping of glacial deposits in the UK. And I've just started off with one particular example, and this is an example of a place in Canada where I've actually been doing some quaternary geology mapping, or working more specifically on quaternary glacial stratigraphy and the distribution of glacial deposits relating potentially to long periods of time with the quaternary. So the field work that I've been doing more recently in Canada has been related to this place, Banks Island. As I say, I'll put this up just as an example of some of the mapping that's done, the quaternary geology mapping that's done in Canada. And here, the map, as you see, which we'd often refer to as the drift version of a geology map, includes the quaternary surface materials. In the Canadian system, anything that's green is a till. Various shades of green represent tills of different, either of different ages or of different genesis, slightly different genesis, and I'll give you some examples of different genesis later. These are tills of different ages, so the darker the green, the more recent the till. So the advances here, which are summarised in these maps down in the bottom right, the most recent advance, the last glaciation, is represented by the dark green. You see the last ice advance onto the island from the east and wrapped around the north and the southernmost shorelines. And then the oldest glaciation is represented by the lighter green over here. So the intermediate green in the middle is the intermediate stage glaciations. And it was proposed that on Banks Island there were four separate glaciations. It is, over time, as we've reassessed all of this, it appears that what was mapped here was largely a representation of the underlying bedrock geology, which is reflected in the tills themselves. And rather than these being tills of different ages, they're just tills which reflect the underlying lithology, bedrock lithology. We've now worked out by various means that it was all glaciated during the last glaciation, and so therefore the differentiation of tills according to lithology and genesis relate more to what took place during the last glaciation in terms of erosion and reworking of underlying materials. So This then is just an example. It's a case study, and it's one that I've worked on recently, and it's a case study of what of how quaternary geology has been advanced in Canada in particular, systematically since the 1950s. So what they undertook from the 1950s up to the present is a compilation of a database of all the Earth's surface materials across a predominantly glaciated landscape, which Canada is. And this involved initially the intensive assessment of aerial photographs. Maps then were produced, which are referred to as the surficial geology maps, and genetic classifications were then added to some of these in terms of the origins and the ages of the tills. And then the stratigraphies, the quaternary stratigraphy, then gives us an impression of the subsurface complexity of those. And I'm not going to go into that in so much detail today, but we can actually see a stratigraphic record of these surface materials on this landscape. Now, the interesting thing about the quaternary geology in Canada and the surficial geology mapping is that they provided us with some very good examples of how to proceed with this type of mapping. And it's one thing that in the UK we didn't do. And right from the outset, they decided they were going to map quaternary geology across this glaciated landscape, this vast glaciated terrain, in a systematic way. So that when I undertook my master's research and also my PhD research in North America, I was given a small amount of money, a small grant to help me do my research. And the understanding was that the Geological Survey of Canada would then take my thesis, but also the map that I was supposed to produce as part of my research, they would use that map in the compilation of the database of the quaternary geology of the whole of Canada. So that now, when you roll out the quaternary geology of Canada, which used to be called the glacial map of Canada, because obviously the quaternary geology was dominated by glacial sediments, if you look at the back of that map, there are hundreds and hundreds of citations of where the maps have come from that have been put together to make the glacial map of Canada or the quaternary surficial materials of Canada. And each of us who did a master's and a PhD thesis, which was sponsored by the Geological Survey of Canada, our theses are there as part of that database. The understanding was that we all mapped systematically. We all defined sediments in the same way. We all used the same colour code classification. And therefore, systematically, we put together a map of quaternary geology relating to glaciation for the region. In the UK, we didn't do that from the outset. And so we have actually been trying to do this retrospectively very recently. So what essentially did Canadian quaternary glacial geology do well? First and foremost, as a glacial geomorphologist, what it delivered for me was it identified process form regimes, and it also acknowledged that there was a complexity, a spatial and temporal complexity in the landscape, which you could read from the surficial geology. And some major conceptual breakthroughs were made within glacial geomorphology which stemmed from this. And I've just given you one very good example here, which is a paper by Dyke and Morris, 1988. And this is probably one of the most widely cited papers in glacial geomorphology. And it was a short summary of the quaternary geology of Prince of Wales Island in the central Canadian Arctic. And it was based upon the mapping from the first Landsat satellite imagery, which was available at the time, as well as extensive field work and field sampling of the surface materials, of the tills of the surface. And this is the image. This is the famous image, which everyone will recognise now who does glacial geomorphology, is the first time that paleo ice stream imprints were identified in the landscape, and more than that, overprinted paleo ice stream imprints. So what you're looking at here is part of Prince of Wales Island. You'll be able to see here a carbonate-dominated terrain, which is the lighter colour, and then the igneous terrain, which is the darker colour appearing on the image. And what you'll see here is that the limestone material has actually been smeared in this direction across that landscape, and it coincides with a whole series of lineaments within the landscape, which are here of drumlins and flutings, which indicate fast glacier flow. There is another set of lineaments running this direction, representing flow in this direction, and another set which run up in this direction, which are less obvious on the image. And with respect to the sequence in which these materials were smeared across the landscape in streamlined landforms. We've numbered them here. Number one, which goes this way, number two, which goes this way, and number three is the late stage flow, which goes this way. And from this, Dyke and Morris identified the fact that ice sheets are not stable features with stable flow, continuous in one direction over time. They'll actually change shape over time, and the flow direction changes shape. And you can chart that from mapping out the different till units, and that's essentially what they did here. And so from this came these the famous dispersal trains, the till dispersal trains, the Boothia type and the Devant type. The Boothia type was based upon this area here, the Boothia Peninsula. And the reconstructions, the paleoglacial reconstructions you see in the maps on the far right-hand side, show the interpretation of how the ice sheet in this particular part of the world changed shape and flow direction over time, over a very short period of time, hundreds of years worth of time scale here in terms of the dynamics of the ice sheet. So a major breakthrough here was actually came from the mapping of sufficial units, in this particular case, various till lithologies. So cross-cutting subglacial bedforms, paleo ice streams, and also the concept of cold-based ice versus warm-based ice, because you can only preserve that record if the ice isn't constantly smearing everything out. So you must be able to preserve it. This is warm-based, fast-flowing ice. This is cold-based ice around it at the time that these are produced. So all those concepts came from that one paper, from that one mapping program in the central Canadian Arctic. So that's just a snippet really of why the Canadian Quaternary geology was very good for glacial geomorphology generally, and those are the spin-offs that came from that very systematic approach. Let's have a look then with respect to some of the aspects with respect to the concepts and the approaches that were taken in terms of the UK and the UK approach to assessing the quaternary geology, our glacial quaternary geology in this part of the world. And I've taken this an engineering approach here because very recently I've been trying to apply some of the work we do to engineering geology with some colleagues from the GeolSoc, from the engineering geology group at the GeolSoc. And I've been working with them on improving what we've generally referred to as a rather impoverished glacial ground model in an engineering sense. And that's summarised here. I'm not getting a Fuchs et al. For any particular reason. This is really the statement or the representation of how we see glacial landscapes in the typical engineering ground model which is presented by them and by others previously. And it's this representation, this three-dimensional representation, shows us the relationship of landforms and sediments as our official geology, as our quaternary geology. And what it represents is essentially a mountain landscape, a glaciated valley mountain landscape, and that has become the standard glacial ground model. So this is one of a number of engineering ground models, and there it is at the top of the list, the glacial valley terrain, also identified for a wider remit are periglacial terrain, semi-arid and temperate, Mediterranean, desert, savanna, wet tropical and mountain terrain. So in terms of glaciation, which is actually really quite diverse, as I've just shown you with some examples from North America, we've chosen a glacial valley, glaciated valley terrain. And hopefully I'm going to show to you throughout the talk here that we've got an awful lot more than that that we can actually use as ground models, which would be indicative of different terrain conditions, even in an island as small as ours. So the problems then, the problems in glaciated basins in particular, with this ground model actually showed no variety in glaciated terrain types. For example, there are lowland glaciations, there's plateau glaciation styles, there are lots of different glaciation styles in addition to glaciated valley. There's no account here of the huge sedimentological and stratigraphic complexities, i.e. the style and the pattern of glaciation, how that changes temporally and spatially over time. And they're really, at this point in time, there's a serious need to incorporate an awful lot of significant advances which have taken place, not only in glacial geomorphology, but also in glacial sedimentology and glacial stratigraphy. And that comes from the mapping of these complex, what we call process form regimes, different land form types, landform process form types. Okay, let's just have a look at some of the variability, which we have acknowledged in the UK over time. I'm glad John's in the audience because he'll recognise some of his work here, particularly on the NIREX from 1997. And these are some of the approaches which have been taken to acknowledge greater complexity in the British glacial record, in the Quaternary geology record. So Isles and Dearman's map from 1981 identified the difference between upland and lowland glaciation with respect to the extent of erosional landscapes versus depositional landscapes, the thickness of drift in relationship to glacial processes. Top right is just a snippet from our engineering geology or superficial map of the United Kingdom, which summarises the variety of sediments at the land surface. In terms of glaciation, really, when we look at this in detail, most of this is coloured blue. And in the UK, blue means till. There is an awful lot more complexity beneath all of that, and so that's something that really we want to just drill down in, if you like. A good example of that, and I always use this for my students, which you'll be glad to hear, John, we often use NIREX as a good case study of how to get into some of the complexity beneath all of this. So beneath the surface, there's an awful lot more than what engineers would call glacial soils. There's an awful lot more complexity to it all. And you can see the significance of that when you look at some of these. So here's the hydrogeological domains that were identified in NIREX. These are the quaternary domains. And these colour codings summarise for us various combinations of sediments which you see in a complex stratigraphy, which are created by different process form regimes, different styles of glaciation. So that we can't just go to a engineering geology map, such as the one top right, and point at the map and say, well, I'm going to predict there is going to be 20, 30, 40 metres of whatever we want to call it, boulder clay underneath or till. There's going to be an awful lot more than that. And a simple case scenario, hydrogeologically speaking, there's an awful lot of complex sand and gravel, stratified sand and gravel deposits within that quaternary sequence. And furthermore, it's probably going to have been heavily glacier tectonised and disturbed and faulted and folded, the complexity of which, when I first used to show this to engineering geologists about 20 years ago, were horrified that anything could be so complicated because they were, as far as they were concerned, it was boulder clay from top to bottom, which again, I still find quite surprising. So we have moved on from that. And I say NIREX is a really good example of that, of moving on. So in terms of what we would call these complex systems, this complex stratigraphy, we tend to use the term glacial land systems, which is what Nick Iles and the Iles and Dearman map come from. Nick Iles' first attempt to do this back in 1983 in a book called Glacial Geology. And these are the various glacial land systems we were acknowledged at the time, indicating that greater complexity. Now, these are various settings which were drawn up by Iles to summarise different locations. So we have thin drift or thin glaciogenic drift. Here's our mountain or glaciated valley land system, bottom left. Here's our glacial ice on hard beds with thin drift and glacial fluvial sediment. And then top right are our thick till sequences, which are complex till sequences with stratified sediments. And in the middle, these guys all hark to this guy in the middle here, which again is a very important landmark paper in glacial geomorphology, paper by Clayton and Moran, which was published in 1974, largely based upon the landforms and sediments around the southern Laurentide ice sheet in Dakota. And it identified what they called a processed form model, whereby we had a complex set of landforms and sediments which related to a particular set of processes taking place at the ice margin. In that particular case, lowland continental ice margin. And this was the one that was largely repeated in all the textbooks, and you'll still see it this day in Strahler and Strahler and physical geology textbooks. You'll see that model reproduced, even though it in itself It is also now regarded as somewhat simplistic and oversimplified. So these were all a land systems model, as Iles and Fuchs had introduced this concept. Land systems were forms, a process form model. So at the top there, I've given you the definition of a land system, and I'm going to be talking about land systems from now onwards, because if you like, they're our ground model. We've tended to use the term land system and ground model now interchangeably, which in themselves are also process form models. So a land system is an area of common terrain attributes different from those of adjacent areas, in which recurring patterns of topography, soils and vegetation reflect the underlying geology, past erosion of the interstitial processes and climate. So it can be applied to any landscape anywhere, which is essentially how Fuchs had originally used that term and how it had been introduced in the late 1940s. So what we're doing is we're talking about glacial land systems and using them to allow us to classify that complexity. So what I want to do is I want to give you now an impression of why we can speak now with authority about the accuracy of a process form model and how we can come up with varieties of process form models. We can do this because we're working with modern analogues by going to more and more real glaciers, glaciers that are operating in the present day. And because they're all now retreating quite rapidly, that's actually doing us a bit of a favour because it's actually exposing lots of fresh landforms and sediments. And because we can chart these through aerial photography, satellite imagery, and ongoing survey, we can actually relate process to form more and more accurately. And so we can come up with more and more accurate process form models or glacial land systems. So I want to start with this place, Breiðamerkurjökull in Iceland, which again is very important in terms of how glaciology and glacial geomorphology is developed. And it has an important part to play in understanding Quaternary glacial geology. And this is the ultimate modern analogue, if you like. And this was initiated by a research team in the University of Glasgow in the 1960s. Particularly this guy here, Rob Price, some of you may have heard of before. He wrote a book on glacial and fluvioglacial geomorphology back in the early 70s. And this guy down here, Gordon Petrie, who was essentially the guru of geodesy, basically. He was working at Glasgow at the time. He's still at Glasgow. And the two of them got together to work on the Breiðamerkurjökull foreland in Iceland by taking aerial photographs. In 1965, they flew their own aerial photographs, had their own ground survey control, and this is the map they came up with of the ice margin and the sediments and landforms, predominantly the landforms associated with the ice recession, compared to the first aerial photographs flown in 1945, which they mapped retrospectively using their ground survey controls. I was lucky in the early 1990s to replace Rob Price when he retired in Glasgow. And when I got there, I thought I'd like to do another map. And so in 1998, we returned and came up with this map here. So we charted the glacier through these three time slices. And by doing that, we could actually assess the evolution of landforms over time. So what I want to show you is some examples of how we've charted the glacial geomorphology, how the process form relationships have been determined based upon this long period of assessment of landforms. For those of you who know him, that's a young Jim Rose at the back there, as a PhD student when he was working with Rob Price. Okay, Breiðamerkurjökull legacy then. This is the part of the legacy that comes from Price's work in the 1960s. And the process form model which came from this gave us a whole load of diagrams, these models, these conceptual models, which were then reused over and over again in glacial geomorphology and geomorphological textbooks. Particularly this guy at the bottom, which is a three-dimensional sketch of the types of landforms, the associations of landforms, which were identified on Breiðamerkurjökull, which related to ice marginal retreat in a lowland setting. And this was compiled by Rob Price based upon the mapping in 45 and 65. This is just a snapshot of the aerial photography from 1998. Those are our photographs. And it shows the detail that we can be gleaned in terms of the glacial geomorphology, whole series of inset push moraine ridges, which can be mapped in here, and flutings associated with them. The top right, the right-hand panel shows assessments or ground survey from 1950 through to 1960 of the surface of an outwash deposit which accumulated at the glacier margin supraglacially. And as that accumulated over time, so in the early stages, in the early 50s, it appeared like a sand or outwash plain, steeply descending outwash plain, which was being deposited over glacier ice. The presence of glacier ice underneath that would not have been determined until later on when the melt-out produced the Cayman Kettle topography, which was charted. Now, this all now, to everybody who looks at this, and well, we all know that. We've known that for a long time. Yes, we've known it since these guys worked it out. This was when they charted what was going on. This cross-section here is another nice example. This is the long profile of an esker, which was emerging on the foreland of Brailer. Surveyed in 1965 is the broken line at the top, and then surveyed again 1 year later in 1966. Now, this really was a benchmark observation at the time, and really this was a bit of a sleeper in the literature, because what it showed was that this esker had ice underneath it. So otherwise it wouldn't have been dropping by that much in just a year. That indicated that the esker was predominantly glacial. It was in the ice as a tunnel. And if you think about it, we predominantly think of eskers being produced by subglacial drainage systems. This clearly demonstrated that that wasn't the case. So I'll come back to that in a sec. So a process form model was produced, and this is an example of that process form model, which was based upon all these observations, real-time observations of glacial process. And a process form model, we haven't defined this yet, it's a conceptual model that emphasises the genetic interrelationships of specific landform sediment associations at both local and regional scales in terms of known process and form linkages. In glacial geomorphology, this is the most difficult thing to do, known process form linkages, because everything moves so slowly, everything is so inaccessible. So the more charting of ice margins that we do, the more we get to know. And this was the first step in that process. So this here was the first process form model from a modern glacier margin. I put question marks. I think that's the case as far as I can tell. And it was published in, another benchmark paper in 1969 by Rob Price, and it was on Brailer Murkioff. And I always tell my students, if you don't read anything else in relationship to my course, read Rob Price 1969, because it is a benchmark statement in terms of glacial geomorphology. So let's have a look at what we got from this, and I'm going to use now the illustrations from the paper that myself and Dave Twigg wrote in 2002, which was a follow-up, if you like. It was based upon the 1998 mapping that we did. And these are screen grabs from the 1998 map, which is our mapping. Note now that in Iceland, and I'm following the tradition here that was set up by the University of Glasgow, tills are now orange, and the outwash is coloured yellow, lake sediments are a light green colour. Aerial photograph showing very strongly streamlined landscape with push moraines, flutings related to fast glacier flow, and the push moraines related to re-advances during the winter, which we relate now to active temperate glaciers like we see in the North Atlantic, warm-bedded wet-based glaciers. The photograph on the far right is an orthophoto mosaic, which is the 1945 photography, and at the bottom is the land system model, the updated land system model that we've produced based upon not just Rob Price's work but all the other information that we've gleaned from active temperate glacier margins. Recessional push moraines, eskers, flutings, they all relate to wet bedded conditions and deformable bed conditions, deforming tills, which are also occurring underneath Brailer Murkioff. So we identified within this some classic signatures within respect to our domains, geomorphological domains, if you like. Firstly, a marginal morainic domain, so important, is the step sequence of recessional push moraines, which you see on each of these, which represent active recession. The ice margin must be moving forward each winter in order to push up a push moraine, even though it's retreating. And that relates to constant flow forward of the ice, even when it's retreating, because it's got a negative mass balance. Secondly, the glacier fluvial domain, which is represented here by everything that you can see in yellow, this represents the huge amounts of sand and gravel outwash created by wet-bedded glaciers. And here we have the development of our ESCA systems, our sand plains, our outwash, our Cayman kettle topography. And then, in addition to that, occasionally you see glacial lacustrine sedimentation, which takes place in these over-deepened areas of the bed, where the ice has actually over-deepened the bed and produced these depressions which fill with meltwater, and so therefore create proglacial lakes during recession, important in terms of the build-up of glacial lacustrine sediment. And then thirdly, the subglacial domain, which is everything you see in orange, which has on it these very well-developed flutings, which represent subglacial deformation. And this is something that was proven in the late 1970s and 80s by Geoffrey Bolton when he undertook his experiments at the same glacier to prove definitively that the glacier margin was not only sliding over its bed but also deforming its bed, producing deformation sediments. Let's just give you a few bits and pieces of detail. And this is even more recent now. These are the results of some work that a PhD student of ours has just finished on Braden Merkiocha. We've now got to the point where we now start draping modern aerial photographs over dems. And this is a view looking across two of the major ESCA systems. That's one ESCA system running across here. And you can see it's quite a complex feature. It's got a fan shape to it here. There's another ESCA running across here. And you'll notice that it runs up and down the topography. The interesting thing about ESCA system number one, this one over here, is it ends at the apex of an ice contact fan with lots of pits around the apex, indicating that it was ice contact. And we call these ESCA system 1 and 2, main ESCA system 1 and 2, MES 1 and 2. And if we chart them as they evolve through time from the aerial photography, from 45 to 55 to 65 to 2007, which is our most recent photography, we can see how these ESCAs emerge over time. And notice how their complexity also emerges, even though the ice is long gone. And so this verifies to us the fact that there's a lot of outwash sitting around, which just looks like a flat surface when it first exposed. And the reason it's a flat surface is because it's prograded over the top of the ice, as Price predicted, as Price charted. And when it downwastes, the tunnel fills, which are in the ice, start poking through. They start emerging through the top of the outwash. So we see landforms emerging long after the ice has retreated. And that's essentially what these guys are illustrating to us. So that's just a summary of what I've just said. So in 1965, there's another one of these aerial photograph drapes. You'll see that the ESCA is emerging. It's melting out of what's called Maravigdorond, which is a name for the lateral, for the medial moraine on the glacier. And the reason that we're getting a big ESCA here is because there's lots of debris in the medial moraine, and that's obviously the end glacial tunnelers reworking that sediment. In 2007, same approach. So here's our ESCA again. The ice is now long gone. We're looking at the same ESCA, and you can see that the changes in detail in terms of the geomorphology of that ESCA. In 2007, the ESCA appears to have decreased in size relative to the more distal ESCAs, which are in red arrows. So the red arrowed ESCAs are similar in terms of their morphology. The yellow ESCA, which is obviously much more prominent in 1965, by 2007 has almost disappeared, verifying Price's ice core predictions, or essentially his ice core measurements, basically, measured it by identifying the drop in the surface topography. So these are the models we've come up with more recently. As the same image again, showing you these two ESCAs. So ESCA system number one, which is this guy running across here to the apex of this big fan, which is here. Our interpretation there in these fairly crude cartoons up in here show what we think is taking place. An end glacial stream feeds the ice contact fan in panel A at the top. Then the glacier surface eventually lowers during retreat, so the top of the fan, suddenly the ice drops below the top of the fan. So the end glacial meltwater can no longer access the fan top, because the groundwater table is effectively dropped. So that means now our meltwater has to get out some other way. And what it does is it actually makes its way along the base of the fan, and it produces this beautiful little esker which runs all the way along the ice contact face of the fan. So this shows how these things evolve through time and how they also respond to the change in topography, which is being produced by ice recession and thinning. Number two, this is a whole different kettle of fish. Apologies if you're getting inverted relief on that. They shouldn't look like channels. They should actually look like positive relief. You have to sit upside down to actually see if you're getting inverted relief. But essentially, you have to believe me that each of those lines there represents a reach. Okay, and so this particular esker ends in a fan shape of eskers. The interpretation here is that what's happened is the end glacial tunnel, or meltwater comes in superglacial, goes into a moulin, goes end glacial, and then emerges in a superglacial position. So an outwash fan is deposited over the glacier snout, which is again what Price predicted and what Price charted. So that what then takes place over time is that the outwash engulfs the glacier margin, it produces a flat-topped fan surface. So that when the ice eventually melts out, the infilled channels will only appear much later on, which is what we demonstrated with the aerial photographs. Okay, so that's just some case studies of Brademerkioccal and what we've done with Brademerkioccal, just to give you a flavour of what we can do in terms of understanding process and form. And it's a long game, this one. And if you're going to get NERC to try to fund something that's a long game like that, it's just next to impossible. So you have to be dedicated, which is essentially what we are, because we're interested in glacial geomorphology. So let's have a look at another case study. This is a place called Kvaerjökull, which is just round the corner from Brademerkioccal. And here we've got something that's very interesting because it's representative of many mountain glaciers or even Piedmont lobes, which are presently retreating very quickly on the Earth's surface. There are a whole load of implications associated with this, many of them actually related to flood and hazards, flood risks and hazards within mountain terrains. What's happening here is these glaciers are downwasting and retreating into what we call their overdeepening. The overdeepening is the overdeepened part of the bed where glacial erosion is concentrated during average glacial conditions. So there's always a low point in the bed. And these glaciers are retreated now, so they're sitting over the top of that low point. So that low point fills with water. And so we have a proglacial lake right at the glacier margin. Kvaerjökull is a perfect example of this. So again, we can chart from 1945 photos, 64, 1980, 1998, the areas to 2003. The areas represented in black here are three areas of hummocky moraine identified in the 2003 photographs and then placed in exactly the same place geographically on each photograph to show how those landforms have been produced. What we also see here emerging on the glacier surface are end glacial eskers. Here we can actually see the end glacial eskers melting out on the glacier surface over time. It shows us that the drainage within this glacier is actually bypassing the bottom of the overdeepening. So you've got this big 100 metre deep overdeepening, which we know is there because we've done ice radar across it. But the meltwater in the tunnels is not going down through that overdeepening, it's going through the ice and bypassing the overdeepening. We also have extensive cane terrace formation along the inside of what is a huge lateral moraine arc. So this photograph here gives you an idea. These are the lateral moraines of the Kvaerjökull. They're about 100 metres high, so the debris turnover is huge. The ice has retreated off to the right of this photograph. There's the proglacial lake. Here's a cane terrace below the lateral moraine. And this area here is ice core topography. That ice core topography is developing into hummocky moraine. I'm sure you've all heard the term hummocky moraine before, but that covers a whole basket of evils, really. And we tend to just use the term hummocky terrain now because we can't be that certain about its morainic origin, if you like. And also, hummocky moraine has the connotations of ice stagnation, and we don't think all of it is related to ice stagnation. Now, this is a good example of this. This is actually more what we refer to as controlled moraine. And if we look at the debris from here in the ice cores, we actually see that each of the ridges within that hummocky moraine, so it's not actually truly hummocky, it's got lineaments in it, ridges within it. Each of the lineaments, the ridges, we can trace back to a debris band in the ice, in the underlying ice. So that's what we would call controlled moraine, because the debris concentration is controlled by the englacial structure. And this feature, and I'll show you examples in a second, actually has been freshened up, or it's been bulldozed. The ice has pushed into it, and it did this in the mid-1990s, and I'll show you the evidence for this in a second. And it, therefore, the debris, the hummocky terrain itself, relates to waves of debris making their way to the ice margin and being freshened up through time. And we produce these in blocks. So A, B, and C of these represent zones or arcs of hummocky topography, hummocky terrain produced in this way. And because of this, the term incremental stagnation was used to refer to this process. That was a term that was coined by Nichols in the late 1970s using this particular glacier. And over time, we've actually proven him to be correct because we've charted that taking place by using the aerial photography and the survey. So let's just show you how this works. Again, the mapping on the left, which I've shown you just to show we've done the maps, 1945, 64, 2003. We've actually got another two within the sequence here to chart the change in the landform and the sediment cover over time. This is the interesting bit over here. These are digital elevation models, and they've been colour-coded to show you essentially where it's green and blue, it shows that we are losing mass, i.e. the ground surface is dropping. Where it goes orange and red, the ground surface is rising. And the interesting thing here is that in the period, so these are time slices based on the aerial photography, in the period 1980 to 1998, the area of the ice core topography, the hummocky terrain that I showed in the previous photograph, rose by 10 metres. It went up by 10 metres. It shouldn't be doing that. It should be going the other way. And the reason for this is that the ice margin re-advanced in the mid-1990s. And that's interesting because most Icelandic glaciers re-advanced in the mid-1990s because they were driven that way by the North Atlantic Oscillation, the regional climate changes, which created a positive mass balance period of about 5 years. So within the geomorphology, what we thought was a stagnating lobe, in fact, is still very strongly coupled to climate, even though it's got a lot of debris on the top of it, which again is an interesting thing to see. And it's interesting to see what, again, the connotations of hummocky moraine, you can see why the problems that has. So this little diagram at the bottom, cross-section, shows us, I'm not going to go into the details, it shows us the various ways in which the debris is brought to the glacier margin and recycled at the glacier margin in a process known as incremental stagnation. So that we can come up with, again, another land system model. So that is just a sketch which shows how these features evolve over time. This is a glacier margin as it stood about 3 years ago, retreating back into its own over-deepening with big proglacial rate. Here's our ice core terrain here, our hummocky topography. Our other bands of hummocky topography are out here, still with ice in them, by the way, 50 years after they were produced. And this is a big ice contact fan with pits on it, which indicate to us, just like Brayden-Murphy Ockel, there's an outwash fan being prograded over the snout. And here, it drops back down into the over-deepening. So we'll have an ice contact face, similar to one I showed you for Brayden-Murphy Ockel with the Esker running to it. When that drains, I can guarantee that's what that landscape will look like, because it's operating in the same way. Okay, I'm just giving you some examples here of modern systems. This is a quite different system, again based on Icelandic case studies, but also based partially on Svalbard case studies, in relationship to surging glaciers. Surging glaciers are those which have this recycling time of surge behaviour, and this particular case is based upon Brúarjökull in northern Iceland, and it surges every 70 years. Last time it surged was in 1964. Prior to that, it was 1890. So those surge signatures are in the landscape and they're on the aerial photography so we can map and chart them out. And this is the land system model that we produce from that. Very different from active temperate signatures. So we can actually say we see that combination of landforms. That's not an active temperate glacier. That's a surging glacier. So it's not giving us a climate signal. So various features. I've just shown you a few.
The diagnostic features of surging glaciers are crevasse squeeze ridges, which are these almost like waffle box pattern ridges that you see in the landscape. They represent the squeezing of sediment up through crevasses, which are created by extension during surging. And then similarly produced zigzag eskers which don't go meandering across the landscape, but zigzag. And the reason they zigzag is because the esker sediment, again, was englacial, but it found the nearest crevasse and shot down that crevasse and then went down the next crevasse. So essentially they're crevasse-aligned eskers, again relating to the extension and the crevassing in the snout. So some other features, very long flutings are created by the ice flow. Proglacial thrust moraines are produced in this particular case. Anyone can tell you what moraine is, till? Forget that one. This is rolled up sand and peat. Okay, that's what the moraine is composed of at Bruiochol. And that's created by the surging of the ice into the proglacial sediments, into the foreland sediments. This is an example of the map of that. Green represent the long flutings. Red represents the crevasse squeeze ridges. Individual very large moraines relate to the various surge positions. You don't see very many moraines, but when you see them, they're big. They relate to this surge activity. So the aerial photograph, again, I quite often say to people, these are the crevasse squeeze ridges you can see on this set of photographs. They're the best crevasse squeeze ridges on the planet. They really are unbelievable. If you ever want to see some really good, as they say in Glasgow, fresh out of the box glacial geomorphology, Bruiochol is the place to see it. Okay, then we're not the only ones to clue in on this, obviously. Other people have worked there. Some Icelanders have worked there more recently. In 2007, they did their own form of mapping landforms and draping them over the den. Again, the identification of the various surging positions. We know it surged. Here's the evidence of the surge margin in 1964. That's actually been charted and observed, so we can relate the process to the form. And this particular example from Ben Dixon from 2009, you can even subdivide the type of proglacial thrust moraine that's created according to the type of materials which are in the foreland. I showed you one where it was buckled and folded peat and sand and gravel, which is this one here. We get various combinations of proglacial thrust stacking the sediments. Okay, last one of my modern examples. This is a modern analogue we've just finished. This is on the summit of the volcano Snæfellsjökull, which is on the western edge of Iceland. That's the glacier as it looks today, with these fantastic lahars and the lava flows on the south side of the summit. The glacial geomorphology is the stuff we're after. This is the superficial geology map again, so again, orange are our tills. And what's very interesting here is we see an area of moraines, which here are mapped in pink. These are ice core moraines. And these are much more prominent in higher altitude, colder conditions in Iceland. And again, these are controlled moraine. You can see where we've mapped in the black lines, they represent the ridges within the ice core moraine, which if you trace them back to the ice cores underneath the moraines, they relate to debris bands within the ice. And this is what they look like on the aerial photograph. You get a whole series of flutings running out to a band of ice cored topography, or this hummocky terrain. That's what it looks like in the field. Just to show you that we've got the ice exposures, these are the debris bands which are feeding the debris. And this particular signature, flutings and drumlins, which represent warm bedded deformation processes, are stopping, they're terminating at ice cored topography, which represents cold based conditions. So the margin of this glacier was freezing onto its bed and dragging sediment to the surface to produce the hummocky topography. So that means that this was an ice cap, this particular ice cap, which is very similar to all the other ice caps, the high altitude systems in Iceland, is polythermal. It's got a warm bedded zone and a cold bedded outer zone because the geothermal heat can escape from underneath the ice, the thin ice at the margin. So we freeze the ice back on and we freeze the debris back on. There's been constantly accreted to the margin by deformation. So this is a polythermal glacier snout signature. So the flutings extend to the ice core moraine. That is a diagnostic signature. Other things really which are interesting here. We call this a unique sediment landform assemblage. it is at the moment, we haven't really applied this to any other volcano-centered glaciers. It's very likely we'll see a similar signature. So we get patchy till with eroded bedrock. We get these flutings extending from those patches, those outcrops of bedrock, the flutings extending to the ice core moraine. But on the eastern side of the ice field, we also get another set of moraines which sit around just outside the ice core moraines, which are made entirely of glacier tectonized pumice. So we've got folded and thrust pumice sequences, which are in a moraine. They're essentially a thrust block moraine made of pumice. And we can look at whichever cross-section we want here, we can actually see the details of this. And it's clear to us that what's happened here is the ice has actually advanced into a pumice blanket on the volcano edge. It's bulldozed it up and pushed it into a moraine system, and then has continued eroding down through the underlying basalt to create the ice core moraines, which are predominantly basalt cored, or ice core with the basalt cover. Okay, so that's some modern assemblages. I'll keep with the modern theme, but here I'm just going to start showing you some of the more recent data acquisition processes. When it comes to mapping glacial geomorphology, I'm very much a Luddite. Yeah, I will go with aerial photographs and a stereoscope on my desk anytime and draw with pens, rotary pens on mapping film. And then we digitise that and transport it into a map. And luckily, we still have a cartographer to do that. And so we should. We're a geography department. There's no reason why we shouldn't have a cartographer. So that's very much how I finish the job off. But I work with people who obviously now work with a lot of the modern digital technology, to the point where we are now investing huge amounts of money in UAVs. We have about 5 or 6 UAVs in the department. They are good fun. They're a flipping faff, and I don't really like spending hours and hours in the field with them, repairing them every time they crash, because they do a crash about once in every 3 flights, if you're lucky. But I'm just going to show you some of the stuff that we've collected by our UAVs. This processing diagram here shows you how we do the survey now with respect to the UAVs. They collect data, very, very high resolution data, but over much smaller areas. So we're now homing in on some specific process form regimes rather than whole forelands. This is the foreland of Flowerjokull, which I mapped in my standard way from aerial photographs. Very similar, it's an active temperate signature, which we see around the forelands of the Icelandic glaciers. So the interesting thing about this guy is he's got a whole series of these red lines in here, you won't be able to see at this scale, which are interpreted as crevasse squeeze ridges, but it's not a surging glacier. And we found out that crevasse squeeze ridges are not necessarily diagnostic of surging by studying this particular glacier. So here's my colleague, Marek Evatoski, is younger than me, so he's got far more enthusiasm and energy for these flipping UAVs. But there's one of the UAVs we use in the department, which is the plane, the smart plane. And from this, then we got these aerial shots. And they're aerial shots, which, looking back onto the glaciers now here, we see the beautifully ornate inset sequences of what we call sawtooth moraines, push moraines, which, because they've got sawtooth patterns to them, which reflect the pecten in the ice, the actual, you know, the longitudinal and radial crevasses. So the ice has actually bulldozed the sediment and squeezed it up to produce these beautiful representations of the crevasse patterns. So these guys are sort of a cross between a crevasse squeeze ridge and a push moraine. And so we see here there's a hybrid that's being produced by this type of glacier. And this is what we've been mapping by this process. So we've developed this not just at Flowerjokull, which is now top right again, but also at a place called Sandfellsjokull. In here, this was all done on the old traditional aerial photograph way. We've identified not just crevasse squeeze ridges, but also winding ridges which look like eskers, and we thought were eskers on the aerial photographs until we got in the field and looked at them and started digging holes in them and found out they were full of till. We now use the term till esker to refer to these features. And we think these are produced in the same sort of process form regime as the crevasse squeeze ridges. We're actually producing tunnels in this particular case, in the base of the ice, which, as soon as they're evacuated by the high-pressure water, produce a low-pressure vacuum, so the subglacial deforming layer squeezes back in and produces a mould. Now, clearly the ice then can't do very much else if we're going to preserve these, so the ice then downweights to preserve them. That's the way we're interpreting the present. What we see in terms of the distribution of landforms is we see these big arcuate assemblages. In this particular case, we've got big overridden moraines with push moraines superimposed on top of them. But we've got crevassing fills and tilleskers, which are related to them, which we think represent a non-surging signature of squeezing of sediment under the ice. In this particular case, they only develop when the ice is back in here. Not out here, but back in here, where it's getting into the overdeepening. Why is that important? Well, we think that's important because it's poorly drained. So all the sediment is squishable, if you want to use a better word. It's going to squeeze up into the crevasse. Crevasse is much easier, and we've developed the longitudinal crevasses much better in the overdeepening. So in terms of process form models, again, what does all this mean? This is our map that we produced of one particular area based on one of our UAV flights. Work out the sequence of retreat from a diagram like that, if you can. Work out how whether or not we've actually got one push moraine every year, which we think we have got. When we see these, it's what they look like on the ground, we map these out, we come up with a process form model for this particular setting, whereby we see the increasing development of more crenulate systems, more sawtooth systems as the ice moves back into the overdeepening, and we start producing the crevasse squeeze ridges at the point where the ice starts to drop down the up ice slope of the overdeepening, where the whole system just gets more waterlogged. So that's modern systems and their applications. Now, before I show you some applications to older quaternary geology, I just want to show you this because I think you'll enjoy this. I'm just putting it on because I think you'll enjoy it. This is something we've done recently when we acquired, some undergraduates came to me, said they wanted to go to Kyrgyzstan to do their dissertations. The alarm bells ringing. You hate going to Kyrgyzstan, it's a bit too dangerous. But they said, oh, we want to go to this place. And they showed me a Google image. I was looking at the Google image of this glacier. And as I panned across the Google image, I saw this. This great big lobe of ice covered in debris, which clearly had a surge snout on it. This particular lobe of ice had surged because it got a load of debris on top of it. And this is brilliant because it's often been proposed that when you dump a big rock slope failure onto a glacier, it will speed up, it will surge. That's never been proven. Okay, there's never really been any clear relationship between the two. I kept panning across the photograph and I came across this. You may have heard of this place. It's called the Kumtor Gold Mine, run by Centerra Gold, a Canadian company. And this is like Armageddon. You know, these are the photographs on the ground. And this is a glaciated mountain, glacierized mountain landscape, which is absolutely beautiful. We've got the early era photographs in the 50s and 60s, and it's pristine, beautiful glaciated landscape. And Centerra Gold have made this huge hole in the ground. And they've removed not just bedrock and mountains, but also whole glaciers. Okay, removed glaciers from the landscape. And this is them removing the glacier. Okay, they're spending just as much time removing because they must have realised that if you start removing ice from the landscape, it will keep flowing into the void you've created. So they spent as much time removing this, moving the ice, as they have been removing the bedrock and getting the oil. Now, what was interesting to us was that this is an image of the ice margin and the extent of the mine around the ice margin. What was interesting to us was what they'd done when they were excavating this. They started dumping the spoil just on the coal in here, on the watershed, just above a series of what were essentially pretty much dead cirque glaciers with hardly any ice in them at all. And they dropped a lot of the spoil onto one of those. This guy started off as one of these little dead little glaciers, stagnating, thin ice loads. And they dumped it on top of it and it initiated a glacier surge. There's really no other way of interpreting it. And that was what was on this image. Just remarkable, absolutely remarkable. So what we did was we got in touch with the Digital Globe Foundation and told them what we were doing. They said, you can have the imagery for free. This is so interesting. We want to see how people are developing and using our product. So they gave us the imagery back to 1999 for nothing. £20,000 worth of stuff just for us to play with, which is just brilliant. So we thought we'd better pay them back. So we rattled off two papers here, which so far have actually been very popular. Of course, they would be, just because the reason I think you find it interesting. So firstly, we actually wrote up something about how the two glaciers responded to having debris dumped on them. And then secondly, we did a land system map. We actually talked about the land system in the area and how it responds to human interactions with glacial systems, which we think is going to be more and more relevant as mining operations extend into permafrost zones. And the really interesting bit is, I'll show you an example. They didn't just stick on this guy. You can't get all your stuff on one tiny little glacier, especially if it starts to surge. Most of the spoil, which has been removed from here, including all the glacier ice, is actually taken into another valley, the bottom of the Davidov Glacier, which has retreated. There's a little ice age limit, and there's loads of dead ice, ice-cored terrain. I've showed you examples from Iceland in the bottom of the valley. And they started to drop the spoil on top of that. Okay? So what it did was it reactivated the dead ice in the valley, and that dead ice started to move forward at quite an alarming rate. And these guys, if you type in Kumtor on Google, you'll get lots of images of this. And it's worth having a look. This is one of those images. It shows what was originally dead ice, stagnant ice, of the stuff, you know, just it had vegetation and everything. It was very, very stabilised. The dead ice here has actually been reactivated and it started to move forward, and it actually started ploughing into their buildings and pushing their buildings over.
So this, as I say, this was intriguing, interesting, and a lot of fun for us, actually.
So, as I say, Digital Globe Foundation provided us with the imagery from 1919 to 2014, and it allowed us to do what we normally do, and that is map changes in glacial process form regimes over time. So this is 1980 aerial photograph. The Lycee Cirque Glacier is the little one that I showed you, we originally worked out was surging. And these are the maps of the surface materials along the bottom through time. So this is the surging Lycee Valley Glacier. There's the first dumping in 1999, which is a bit blurry on that image. It's not a great image. But then by 2002, which is the image you get if you go onto Google Earth, it has surged. And then we see the propagation of that surge all the way down valley. And it's gone further than the nearby Petrov Glacier.
So the Lycee Glacier then is remobilised by the spoil dumping and it surges and initiates a surge. And this is great for us in glacial geomorphology. It proves that a supraglacial debris load can initiate surging. And that's like an inadvertent experiment created for us in real time. This is the other one which is great. This is the Davidov Glacier. So same thing again here. What I've just produced for you there are all the images, because all the images are interesting, because not only did they dump the spoil on the dead ice, they also started to take away the ablation zone of the glacier. So any student of A-level geography will tell you, if you remove the ablation zone of a glacier, it's going to get replaced pretty fast with stuff coming from the accumulation zone. And that's essentially what it did. So it just kept surging as they kept removing material. And as they do this then, these are the images. Here's the material starting to be dumped on the margin of the glacier. The glacier then starts to advance. When we get down into here, we start seeing the hole being excavated into the glacier. So the glacier is starting to get narrowed. And as it gets narrowed, obviously we speed it up and it will then start surging forward. So we get then remobilisation of the ice core moraine as a debris-covered snout, or what was permafrost, it now undergoes permafrost creep. And we actually construct what we think is the first reported human-made proglacial thrust moraine, which is this guy here. And there's the debris covered, and the ice and the debris which was dropped on the ice core moraine. This is the permafrost being thrust up as a proglacial thrust moraine, and that's the remainder of their building, which was incorporated into the thrust moraine. So, this is us then utilising all this modern data. Really, because now the acquisition of data is just so much, it's more accurate, it's got higher resolution, we get a faster return time, we can start assessing these things in a whole number of different places around the Earth's surface. So this film is a real-time exercise for us in mapping glacial land system evolution. Here again are some interpretations of the changes in surface materials over time, and it just shows us how the mine encroached upon the Davidov Glacier over time,
caused it to surge and extend down valley to produce the tectonized permafrost. There must be something that mining geologists may either learn from this, but maybe they don't care. You know, they're just thinking, we're getting more money for the gold, so we'll just keep digging and just keep piling the stuff somewhere else. Now, the interesting thing is they have a license to continue along the forefront of this mountain ice field. So they have a license to move into the next glacier next door, the glacier next door to that, and the glacier next door to that. So it's going to be interesting keeping an eye on that. It's going to be interesting for us because they'll be doing some more real-time models for us. Okay, then that brings me to this, which is always the slide I put up to wake my students up and tell them why it's important and why they might want to make money out of this sort of thing. Why bother with glacial land systems? This really is a summary of what I said, really. Each land system is representative of a glacial signature, and that glacial signature is tuned to the glacier morphology, you know, the type of glacier it is, the glacier thermal regime, i.e. whether it's warm, cold-based or a combination, the glaciation style, the local to regional climate regime, latitude, altitudes, a whole load of things which are tuned here, the glacial geomorphology is tuned into. Land systems treat landforms and sediments as associations in a holistic framework, therefore we don't need to treat landforms in isolation. Land systems allow us to appreciate that the glacial landform landscape legacy is a product of this continuum, a constantly changing spatial-temporal continuum. So we can build a family of land systems suitable to the different, for the wide array of settings. So here are all our various examples. I've shown you active temperate surging. I've shown you a little bit, maybe a subpolar to plateau. We've touched on mountain valleys as well. I'm going to show you some ice stream applications now. So I've just got enough time. I think I have. Is that okay? I'll just show you some examples of how I've applied this. Quaternary glacial geology again. This is the deeper time. This is the ancient stuff as far as we're concerned. Last glaciation, only 18 to 20,000 years ago, but to us it's a long time ago compared to the timescales we're working on. So spatial temporal overprinting. This is a southwest Laurentide ice sheet. So a digital elevation model here, that box represents that area over on the right-hand side. The outlines with the numbers in represent ice stream tracks, fast glacier flow tracks. And you'll see from this, in the same way as Dyke and Morris identified in 1988, we can now identify overprinted fast flow tracks. And this is now a common thing to do in reconstructing ice sheets, even in the UK record. So that area in the box, this is the map, the geomorphology from that, and we've got a whole series of push moraine ridges. I'm now going to zoom in on that box there, which is the detail, the aerial photograph detail, as we come down to that scale. And even within that, so that's the aerial photograph, orthophoto mosaic from that area, we can subdivide our egg moraine types according to how strongly linear they might be or chaotic, whether or not they're controlled moraine or whether they're push moraine. And we see, when we put this together, we can see that either nicely spaced push moraines with flutings, which represent active temperate systems, like we see in Brädermörkur or the Icelandic lowland glaciers, all of these features, linear or discontinuous linear ridges, which are broken up by holes in the ground, Keppel holes, or upstanding circular flat top features called prairie mounds or plains plateaus, which are these guys here, this aerial photograph shot, indicating to us lots of buried glacier ice has melted out. So therefore, they are probably controlled moraine. The interesting thing, therefore, is that we change from controlled moraine to push moraine. As the ice sheet margin retreats, we go from warm-based to polythermal, warm-based to polythermal. The ice margin is changing its thermal regime as it retreats. And we can summarise that very simply in these sorts of diagrams. Again, various forms of map. There's the active push moraine, there's the control moraine. And this is just a simplified model of what they might look like as we go from active temperate to polythermal to frozen back to active. And it indicates to us that the environmental conditions are really important in terms of the recession of the ice sheet, and that's seen in the glacial geomorphology. The context for all this is within this particular ice stream. That just shows you the regional retreat pattern, just for context. As the ice sheet retreated, it switched from that polythermal and active switching system. It switched into a surging system. And the surging geomorphology is represented here. Long flutings, thrust block moraines, crevasse squeeze ridges. These are the classic crevasse squeeze ridges of this particular system. The thrust block moraines, which are actually in Cretaceous bedrock. These all relate to streaming, a surging of the ice streams as they retreated further north. And this, so instead of a normal ice stream retreat pattern, we see something that looks like this. So our ice sheet started to become unstable as it retreated. And we can get that all from our geomorphology. So I summarise all that. There's our knack again. There's all our various ice streams. These are our imprints of how we've changed from active temperate to polythermal margins to surging margins as we move further north, as we move through the system.
I've got one example also from the UK. Again, John will appreciate this, because it's from the Pink Books. It's from the Aggregate Resources Books, which I've suggested that BGS do not throw away, because we use these as examples for teaching this sort of stuff. This is the Brampton Cane Belt on a digital elevation model. So there's Talking Tarn in the middle. And it's made up, if you map it all out, it's made up of a series of discontinuous linear ridges, which are eskers, esker tunnels, bits of esker tunnels, holes, Keppel holes, like Tolkien Tarn itself, and upstanding flat-topped surfaces, which we interpret as ice-walled lake plains, holes in the glacier which filled up with sediment and filled up to a flat surface. And when the ice was melted away, it left with this upstanding flat-topped ridge, which is an ice-walled lake plain. And this is the view looking over the Brampton Cane Belt map topography, and this is just an extract from the map of the resources, from the Aggregate Resources book, the Pink Book. And it shows us the distribution of sand and gravel and the quality of sand and gravel that can be extracted from this type of landscape. So we should be able to predict what lies beneath these sorts of landscapes and predict the quality of the materials which can be extracted from such landscapes. And it's nice to be able to marry up these types of resource manuals with the landform setting, the landforms that you see, to make some sort of attempt at prediction. A modern analogue for this is a diagram that we drew up which just shows how Brampton Cane Belt evolved. It's essentially producing a glacier cast system, a honeycomb system, which is gradually the holes and the tunnels just get bigger and bigger and fill more and more with sand and gravel. So we superimpose all these cones, kettles and ice-walled lake plains one on top of each other. And modern analogue, again, this is an Icelandic case study, a place called Sandfellsjökull. Here the glacier margin, glacier margin is here. This is a Canyon Terrace sequence, and here you can see all the pits of the melting ice. And you can see that some of these pits are elongate, they represent tunnels running through the ice, which are now collapsing. And so, eventually, this is going to be a Talking Tarn. On the far side of the glacier, the result of all the melt-up is here. These are our cane terraces, inset cane terraces, and pitted surfaces, and partial esker ridges, which essentially is exactly what we see in the Talking Tarn setting. And that takes us, I guess, full circle as well, back to Kvíðarjökull. I told you all about the emerging eskers, the end glacial eskers. This is us on the glacier surface 2 years ago. There's an end glacial esker emerging on the glacier surface. Here's another one emerging at the margin of Vikarjökull, Fagrajökull, which is forward, again, confirming Price's observations. We can relate all these, again, back to our model and use these as modern analogues of what's taking place in these sorts of landscapes. Right, just to finish with then, I'm going to put this in the context of how things are moving on, i.e. the status of quaternary domains or mapping of land systems, if you like, in the UK. As I said here, it's time to surpass the Canadian quaternary geologists. It's time to move on one stage beyond what they've achieved. And I think this does it. This came out just recently, Booth et al. 2015. We now have a map of the UK and the types of domains, the types of landform sediment associations we might see in that landscape. And this paper is a great one because it actually allows us to quantify to some extent the quality of the materials that you're going to extract from these terrains. And it tells us all about lowland glaciation, upland glaciation, glacier morphology, glaciation style. It tells us all about the complexity that I've been talking about. So this is I'm going to go into all the details here, but this is a really good example of how to apply our knowledge of glacial process form models.
I've been trying to attempt to put this into some sort of overview of case studies of glacial land systems with my engineering geology buddies at the GeolSoc. And later this year, we have a big tome, a huge volume on quaternary engineering geology, and this is going to be part of that. So just a little snippet, just to give you a flavour. And I've subdivided the UK according to the various settings that I've introduced you to in modern landscapes. So I shoot related land systems, and here, I'll just give you some examples of locations. You can read those at your leisure. Upland glacial land systems or hard bedrock terrains. Glacier fluvial sediment landform associations. Brampton is a good example of one of those. And then subaqueous settings in which we see sedimentation largely below water. Well, I haven't really talked about them at all really this evening, but that's just one depositional setting. So that vast complexity that we see, we think we can now incorporate within maps and assessments of the glacial geomorphology, the quaternary geology of the UK. That's probably enough for me. I've gone way over time. So thank you for giving me the time to come talk to you about all of this. Hopefully I've given you a few bits and pieces to think about in the future. Thank you.
Does anybody have any questions for Dave?
John Brown from Ovar Partners. You showed us lots of illustrations of the preserved glacial forms. Is that quite rare? You know, have you picked out all the good examples from different areas? Is it mostly wiped out by the glacial process or
what, in an ancient setting in the,
yeah,
the UK?
Yeah.
No, signatures are there. Sometimes they can be quite subtle. But no, signature. Yes, I've given you... Yeah,
they're more distinct and well-developed. And
yeah, the peachy ones are on those as examples. Yeah. But that doesn't mean to say we can't go to any glaciated landscape in the UK and not be able to identify a glacial signature. If it is subtle, it means that it's been a system which is sediment-starved, debris-starved. And we have examples of that, settings in which we see that sort of thing. So I'll give a couple of examples that I've worked on recently. The North Pennines, I'm just finishing off a map of the North Pennines. The reason I started on the North Pennines was I moved there. When I moved to Durham, I thought I'm going to live in the Pennines. I'm not going to live in Durham. Live in the Pennines. So I live near Middleton in Teesdale. And I thought I'd look up the literature of Middleton in Teesdale, glacial geomorphology. Dwerry House, 1902. That's your lot, nothing else. Very good paper, a lot of really good observations in it. But nothing at all. And I thought, well, why is that? It's a bit odd. And then I started walking around and looking at the landscape. It's hard to see any glacial geomorphology. When you start manipulating the digital elevation model, it starts to jump out at you. The landscape's full of streamlined landforms and drumlins. There's some magnificent meltwater channels which are developed in the area. And that tells us a lot. It tells us that predominantly the ice was deforming deformable bedrock. There's a lot of shale bedrock in the area, which has allowed plucking of overlying and intervening limestone slabs. So there's some interesting, what we call bedrock glacier tectonite going on in the area, which is interesting to me. It was a system which predominantly was documented by its meltwater signature. Like glaciers will never retreat from a landscape leaving nothing, even if they're sediment starved, because they have to melt. And when they melt, they produce lots of meltwater. So like in the Iceland case, they produce sand and gravel. In the Pennines, they produce an awful lot of eroded bedrock in glacial meltwater channels. So that's just one example. More controversially recently, we identified evidence for glaciation on Dartmoor. And I still think there are a few people that don't believe us, but it's for us, it's a hypothesis to be tested. We undenied about this for a long time, because numerical models of ice sheet reconstructions of the UK can't stop Dartmoor being glaciated. It's too high. Too big an expanse not to have had ice on it during previous glaciations, but it was right at the margins of glacier production, so therefore it didn't have much power, didn't really produce much sediment, so the evidence is really subtle, really subtle. Now, there are some local soil scientists, geologists who have retired to the area or worked in the area for years, still refusing to believe it. But in the field, I asked them to provide me with an alternative interpretation of what we mapped. And they didn't really have one. Well, they had some, but they really were clutching at straws. So I think the reason we had the confidence to go there and identify these signatures is because we worked in landscapes where the signature was subtle, bankside being a classic case, of very thinly developed tills when the ice was in its most expansive. There, not because the ice, it wasn't, it's only subtle, it's subtle because the ice was small, the ice is very big, but it was very cold-based in its early stages of the Grants. So it didn't really produce much, it became polythermal during the session, so you get darker and darker greens in the till classification scheme. So, long answer to a short question, but it's an important one, because yes, people want to know the fast answer to something. Can I do this? Is this possible to map or come up with a signature in an area? Yeah, it is, but the signature might be subtle. So, and this is my selling point for what we do. You need a glacial geomorphologist on your team, yeah? Somebody who knows what they're doing in terms of identifying, someone with the experience to do that. And hopefully that's what we provide our students with to some extent. But yes, you can. I actually find the subtle signatures just as interesting as the really obvious one. The really obvious ones, everyone's been crawling all over. You know, they're easy to interpret. It's the difficult ones providing with the challenge.
Okay, thank you for that. Yeah. And can I just say thank you for including so many references. That's going to give me plenty of reading.
Yeah.
Any more questions?
I can confirm from a career of mapping glacial deposits, it's very striking that every area I've worked in within the glacial limits, when you look at the landscape, you look at the distribution of the landforms, of the distribution of the superficial deposits, and you look at the form of present day rivers and features, nearly everything relates to a period of just a few years during the deglaciation of the last ice sheet. Firstly, you can understand how the ice sheet retreated from the landforms, and also you can predict from your knowledge that we have many aspects of quaternary geologies from that knowledge.
Yeah, I always find it remarkable that most of what we see relates to just the last glaciation. There have been 20 odd of them, you know.
Yeah,
and where's all the other stuff?
The last 14,000 years is that. Many areas is actually a very, very, very subtle imprint.
Tim Pearsby, also DPS, I'm a bedrock sedimentologist. How much control is there of the bedrock on the particular regime of the ice system?
Oh, a lot. Right. A lot.
And is it? Is it the mechanics of that bedrock, or is it the previous inherited topography? That's
both, definitely both. The mechanics of the bedrock are intriguing. As I mentioned, with North Pennines, production of what we call bedrock glacier tectonite, there are certain bedrock types, and this is not terribly surprising to most people, will produce it'll be more efficient at producing till glacial sediment. But there's an awful lot of sediments that we haven't classified as till or till-related in the past because they've just looked like smashed-up bedrock or stuff that we've maybe interpreted as being a periglacial head deposit. Or actually, many of them are not. They are actually glacier tectonite. They're actually subglacially crushed material which has been broken up by glacier ice. And the glacier ice does this with a bit of help from permafrost and from the groundwater that's in the system as glacier ice advances into a landscape. We even find that quite coherent bedrock will actually get plucked and deformed. And there's a couple of remarkable things, again, in the North Pennines. There's a situation just north of Cross Fell. There's a load of bumps in the landscape hills. And I always forget the name of them, the Greenlee Hills. Anyway, when you're on Cross Fell, there's a series of bumps to the north, directly off the summit. And they've got their own names. And the Lambgreen Hills are one of them. There's another bunch. They're interpreted actually as bedrock mega rafts. But the ice has actually taken the summit off, the side off of Cross Fell and shunted it a short distance and dropped it. So when you walk on them, the strata are still horizontal. But they're a bit of a jumble, like a bit of a jigsaw puzzle, but there's, you'd be forgiven for thinking they were just erosional outliers. And I've looked at these for ages now. It was a guy called Angus Lum who interpreted these as this, and they've not been written up in any professional literature, just in his little guidebook, and that's how he interpreted them. And he must have got that. He must have got that suggestion from somewhere else, presumably from BGS mapping and memoirs. And for the life of me, I can't work out why ice at that height. The ice there must have been frozen to its bed. It's quite thin, high altitude. My only impression is that it froze to the cap rocks, the limestone cap rocks. And what you do see in the gullies around this site are thick sequences of mudstones and mud rocks. And I think that it essentially just slid over the top of them. It froze onto them, dragged them northwards, and then dropped them. And it's remarkable, absolutely remarkable. But again, there are lots of things like signatures like that which you'd be forgiven for thinking they were in situ or glaciation and had no impact on the landscape at all. But we're increasingly finding that we need to look at bedrock structures to actually see whether or not ice has been involved in the area, because it actually glacier tectonises the bedrock. So, yeah, and pre-existing weaknesses, pneumatolysis, all these sorts of things, they create the perfect stuff for plucking and moving sediment around and creating diamictons. Like boulder plates, you know, blocks in mush, basically.
Any more questions?
Coming back to that, the BGS maps show cambering along escarpments.
Yes.
Like Chilterns or in the Jurassic escarpments. So just you're saying there, we just have to be a little bit careful, don't we? But, sometimes ice might have shunted these rocks around or done more than we thought hitherto.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. Although permafrost can do some interesting things as well. I've been shown some permafrost structures in southern Britain, southwest Britain, that for the life of me, I can't imagine how permafrost did it. The really deep-seated folds and thrusts in sediment, in kaolinite and stuff like this in the southwest. And I'm looking and thinking, that's an enormous structure, but apparently it's deep-seated permafrost deformation. Remarkable.
Well, thank you very much, Dave. That's been a really, really interesting talk. I've learned more about glaciers than I think I've ever learned, and it's left me with lots of things that I want to read up on, particularly the Brampton area, because that's near where I'm from, so
yeah.
I might be pestering you for some more references.
The big book, John's got copies. Can you?
I can get them all online.
Yeah, they're great resource. And if the engineering geology, the Quaternary engineering geology volume will be worth a dip into. It's going to be monstrous, but it's going to be huge, but I think it'll be a good state of the art of what we understand about engineering properties of quaternary sediments. Was a good start anyway.
Thank you very much. We'll give Dave a round of applause. Thank you.